This is the Financial Sense News Hour. With the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Now, this here tale didn't happen just yesterday, nor the day before. 'Twas a long time ago, and if you'll excuse me for saying so, 'twas better all right. Yes, sir, honey, it happened on one of them zippity-doo-dah days.
Yes, sir, zippity-doo-dah, zippity-yay.
The U.S. has never had a default. It's uncharted, and the rest of us don't know what will happen.
We're in Act One, Scene One of something that's going to be playing out over the next 5 years, the next 10 years, the next 15 years.
We've engaged in fierce and passionate debates about the issues of the day. We have tried to live by the words that Jefferson once wrote. Every man cannot have his way in all things.
I don't think anybody's drawing lines in the sand and saying, unless we get this, we don't do that.
Without this mutual disposition, we are disjointed individuals, but not a society.
The president is adamant that we cannot make fundamental changes to our entitlement programs.
We also want to be clear, we will not support benefit cuts for Social Security or Medicare.
The president basically said three things. Both parties have to come together to solve this. Of course they do. There are solutions out there. And by the way, if you guys figure it out, I'll sign it. He may as well have just said, do you know it's Friday? He said something that we all know, and he is again leading from behind.
It's a zippity-doo-dah day.
Wonderful feeling, wonderful day.
Why, it's just a zippity-doo-dah day in Washington. Just look at that budget battle. Maybe we should say shazam or abracadabra. No, that's not working. How about bibbidi-bobbidi budget? No, I got it. Wait a minute. Budget ceiling, open sesame. Well, none of that seems to be working nowadays. It's always supposed to work in fairy tales, though. Oh, I get it. This isn't a fairy tale. It's a horror story. I see. The Nightmare on Pennsylvania Avenue. Hi, everybody. I'm John Loeffler, and
I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. In the first hour, we'll be speaking with Robin Griffiths. We'll be getting his take on the markets. Robin, he's on the bearish side. Ryan Poplava will also be here to talk about events in the markets this week. And then John and I have quite a few topics to talk about in the big picture. First of all, we're going to talk about this GDP number we got on Friday, which surprised a lot of economists. Remember, the economists and the Fed has been talking about a strong second half recovery. Well, guess what, folks? The economy has gone in a downward trend since Q4 of last year. In the first quarter, we only grew at a 1.8%, and now we got the first preliminary numbers of the second quarter, and we've only grown at 1.3%. So if we're to match the numbers that they're predicting for the year of a 3% to 3.5% economic growth rate, we're going to have to see growth rates in the 4 and 5% in the second half, and John and I will be talking about why we don't believe that's going to be the case.
And people are feeling like they're swimming uphill and spending more and more energy and getting less and less result for it. Do you realize the dollar index reached a high of about 121 back in July of 2001? Now it's 74. That means the dollar has lost 40% of its value, almost half, in the last 10 years. So ultimately, the U.S. is going to have to default on its debt. It's simply a question of how it's going to default on its debt and whether or not the people notice as the defaulting is underway. And we're going to look at a situation that the baby boomers are going to face. The government programs that they've been promised, Social Security and Medicare, there will be increasing denial of provision. There'll be means testing, cutbacks in health care and Medicare. At the very same time, the baby boomers have to live off their investments when government is going to be suppressing the rate of interest. And at the same time, due to the inflation that we're going to see, prices of everything will go up. The entire baby boomer group is going to be in a giant vice. So the real question is, how are you going to find income when interest rates are very close to zero? That and other topics and queue lines here today on the Financial Sense News Hour.
Yeah, let's go to Ryan Poplava next and find out just what went on the market this week. Did not look very well.
Well, Ryan, last week we discussed earnings, and we said last week that this week we would do so as well. A lot of numbers were off. It was not really too good, especially for the politicians who were trying to pump this up as being a great economic recovery. We'll talk about economics as well during the market wrap today.
Right, John. Looking at this week, it was the busiest week that we would see thus far in the earnings season. And where last week was very important because we had our very large cap bellwethers of each sector and subgroup, this week we just have a lot more, just not as important. But it still moved the market in many cases, starting off with healthcare. On Monday, HCA Holdings, the nation's largest for-profit hospital operator, was hit on earnings as profits dropped 22% as we showed fewer surgeries in the last quarter. So with HCA Holdings, the rest of the healthcare group really sold off on Monday, and I think really throughout the week that set the tone. Looking at the next group, industrials were also hit big this week as the weakest sector following a slew of announcements through the week. Some of the week's losers were PACCAR, down 14.28%, 3M down 8.5%, Jacobs Engineering down 8%, Emerson Electric down 10.5%, Manitowoc down 11.8% on earnings. Pacer was one of the few that bucked the trend. It was up 6.3% on earnings, while the rails were mostly flat this week. Materials were soft as well this week, with earnings released for AK Steel down 23%, U.S. Steel down 10% on the week, Goldcorp down 11%, Newmont down 5.4%, American Barrick down 5.4%, Potash down 6%, DuPont down 5% in chemicals. A lot of weakness across the board. The market actually fell down 5 days straight this week, so we generally had some weakness, but earnings were quite a driver in what the sectors performed and did. So looking at the one sector that did okay was technology. Technology held up very well by strong performance in Broadcom. The stock was up 5% this week. And LSI Corporation up 10%. Expedia up 6%. Lexmark up 13.8%. SAP, SAP up 3%. While Juniper down 24.8%. Logitech down 10%. Akamai Technology down 19%, detracted from the group on earnings or guidance disappointments. Interestingly enough, super cap technology stocks are really what are working right now in the market. Apple, Microsoft, and Google explain nearly 45% of the NASDAQ Composite's monthly return, 1 month return, due to their combined 18% weighting and their giant 1 month returns. Looking at Apple in the past month, not the month of July, but in the past month, Apple's up 22%. Microsoft up 15% and Google up 27%. And this is very interesting to me because I look at a lot of technical indicators, and one of them is the cumulative advanced decline line for the NASDAQ. Combines all the breadth in the market and tells us that how many participants are participating in the market going up. We want to see all of them. We don't want to see just a few stocks. And what we have seen in the past month is this cumulative advanced decline line has been dropping for the NASDAQ as the NASDAQ has been approaching its 52-week high. So what that tells us, it's not a very healthy situation. In fact, you know, looking at a battleground, when you have the generals on the front lines and the troops have retreated to the rear, it's not a very hopeful outcome for that type of a battle. So you've got your large cap, which are doing well. In fact, if you look at the earnings last week, when Apple, IBM, Microsoft, Google, everybody announced Google 2 weeks ago, earnings were great for those companies, and likewise, that's where investors are putting their money. The other group that did also well this week was utilities. They were better performance this week based on sort of a defensive move as investors continue to de-risk their portfolios based on this issue with the debt ceiling. So utilities did well. Now, let's switch gears. Looking at economics, we did have some reports that came out this week, although earnings were really the driver in the markets, as well as some of the macro headlines coming out of Washington. But if you look at some of the economic indicators that were released this week, a few that are not as widely reported are the Chicago Fed National Activity Index and the Philly Fed Coincident Index. These are surveys that, as I said, aren't widely covered as the ISM manufacturing surveys, which we'll see next week. But they're pretty important because of how broad in scope they are. You can find them on the web pages of their respective regional federal bank, Chicago, and the Philly Fed. The Philly Fed Coincident Diffusion Index measures the activity in 50 states. It dropped below 50 to 34 for the month of June. Now, every dip below 50 was followed by a recession, with 2010 as the only false signal in the last 10 years, which might not have been the case if it weren't for quantitative easing too. It might have, and in fact, created a recession had we not had quantitative easing. Now, the Chicago Fed National Activity Index, the other one I wanted to talk about, groups about 85 national-level activity indicators. It states that readings below negative 0.7 on this three-month average is recession territory. And this indicator hasn't shown any false signals in the past 45 years, that any time, as I said, a signal gets below 70.7, then we're in recession territory. The June reading that came out to a negative 0.6. So if it drops below 0.7, a negative 0.7, and the Philly Fed remains below 50, this suggests that a recession is months away from beginning. My brother Chris Poplava will have an in-depth report on the matter in his regularly scheduled Friday market observation this week at financialsense.com. But looking throughout the rest of the week of what we saw, in quick order, we saw the Case-Shiller Index rose a seasonally adjusted 0.1% or 1.1% non-adjusted for seasonality. It showed that the West and Florida are no longer the center of trouble. Most of the trouble is more centralized. The June new home sales report showed sales weakness, but also surprising price strength. The median price was up 5.8%. to $235,000, and the average was up 1.8% to $269,000. So while sales fell for the month period of June down 1%, the annual rate to an annual rate of $312,000 versus expectations for $321,000, prices did in fact rise. So it was an interesting situation there in new home sales. New factory orders for durables in June fell 2.1% following the May rebound of 1.9%. Autos, a component of that order, reversed May's rebound of 5.8% by dropping 8.5%. Machinery dropped 2.3%. Now, all other industries actually rose, including primary metals, computers and electronics, and electronic equipment. Jobless claims were a happy break in economics this week as new claims dropped below 400,000 for the first time since early April, when it reached this week at 398,000 claims. The three-week average also dropped about 8,500 claims to 413,250. So a significant trend that has been happening over the past 3 months or so since the Japan earthquake and a lot of autos shut down operations here in the U.S. Jobless claims spiked for about a week, and they've all since come right back down. So that's a positive sign for this economic growth period. Now, GDP for the advance Q2 estimate was worse than believed. It came in at about 1.3% when consensus was expecting about 1.9% growth. So Jim actually will be going into the numbers in more detail later in the show. Now, the last number that came out this week was the Chicago PMI, which came in at 58.8, which was slightly below consensus, but a growing number, decently above a break-even 50. So while new orders were at 59.4, indicating a strong monthly growth rate, back orders also rose in the month at 55.7 versus a contraction in June. So this was a good number. It wasn't as strong as economists wanted to see, but anything above 50 is growth, and we're not dropping below 50 like some of the flash PMI numbers we saw last week in China as well as Europe. So this sample is for all sectors of the Chicago economy and offers a positive signal for continued expansion in next week's National Purchasers Reports from the Institute for Supply Management.
Well, headlines are being dominated by the whole debt ceiling debate, which Jim has made akin to a kabuki theater, given the whole situation of the U.S. debt. It's only a fraction of what we're really dealing with. The euro's been sort of quiet, too, so why don't we look at least those two things? Anything else you think comes up in the economics area?
Now, the economics it'll be an important week next week as we get those numbers from the ISM, as well as the job reports data on Friday. But looking at the headlines, we had quite a few this week, mainly situated with the debt ceiling, and the consensus this week remains that an outright default will be avoided. What's in question is whether we get a downgrade on our debt by the various credit agencies. Now, those agencies met in Washington before the House Financial Services Committee on Wednesday, wanting to shed some light on how they view the competing plans. The Standard & Poor's had already mentioned it wants to see about a $4 trillion deal with broad bipartisan support. Obviously, that's not likely at this point. So looking at Boehner's plan as well as Reid, neither plan seems capable of passing in the opposite chamber. In addition, Obama has threatened a veto on the Boehner plan. Geithner's drop-dead point on the debt limit deadline is August 2nd, next Tuesday. But higher tax collections may be able to squeeze that out to about August 10th. So, you know, were the reserve currency of the world, a downgrade could ripple throughout global markets. And as we have seen over the past few years, global markets are taking their reserves down in U.S. dollars. So essentially implying we are already in the process of losing our reserve currency status, in essentially. But the problem is there really isn't any alternative at this point except for gold. And that's what's working here. Gold is up. The Aussie dollar is up. The Swiss is up. The Brazilian real is up. And the Canadian dollar. So those currencies in this environment where we're dealing with a question of reserve currency status, a possible downgrade on U.S. debt, alternatives like gold, and those foreign currencies based in economies that have surplus trade accounts. These are plays that are working right now. Now, looking at Europe, we had that big bailout package that was finally put together for Greece last Thursday. Enthusiasm for the Eurozone announcement last week waned throughout this week as sovereign debt yields rose on Italy and Spanish bonds. In fact, for the Italy 10-year yield, if you look at it, this week we were nearly at last week's highs. So in addition, credit default swaps have dropped substantially since the Greek bailout plan announcement last week. But they've crept up also slightly here this week. So looking at Europe, there's still the bailout package happened. Credit default swaps dropped substantially, but we already see that they're starting to creep up a little bit here, but especially looking at the yields in the Italy and Spanish bonds, as I believe officials in Germany were stating that they don't know so much how this new bailout program is going to help out those other peripheral nations. But we'll just have to see. So next week, I don't know if we'll have a resolution on the debt ceiling, but I think there was a vote towards the end of the day. The markets had already closed, so we couldn't really respond in the markets towards what's going on in Washington. We'll find out on Monday from all of the news over the weekend how the market's planning to react. We still have that deadline on Tuesday. Economics, again, will be, I think, back towards the center of our conversation next week as we look at the PMIs as well as the jobs report data. And if we have any other headlines from Europe, I'll be sure to let you know.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
The critics of QE1 and QE2, who said it was going to lead to inflation, it would cost the federal government money, have been absolutely proven wrong. And so if we needed a third round, I would be for it. I would hope, however, and I think we've done enough with monetary policy, fiscal policy should come first.
Robin Griffiths from Casino Capital joins us on the program. And Robin, as I look at the major indexes around the globe, whether you're looking in Asia, if you're looking in London, if you're looking in Europe, most of the indexes, with the exception of Germany and maybe Korea, are down for the year. And if I look at the S&P, we've virtually sort of gone nowhere since February. What does that tell you?
Well, it's bearish is the answer. And I look at it from even further away. I have a very simple rule for deciding what is in a secular up or downtrend. Anything that is lower now than it was 10 years ago is in a secular downtrend. And when you run that rule across world stock markets, you come to a very astonishing conclusion that there are no Western markets unsupported by metals, minerals, and resources, so excluding Canada, that are not in secular downtrend and have been for 10 years. What they have is cyclical bull and bear markets around that 10-year falling trend. And we had a cyclical bear to March 03, a bull till late 2007, a bear till March 2009, and we've been in that bull ever since. Now, what's happened is the last three markets are yet to break into the bear market, and those last three are the US, Germany, and just possibly Britain. I've been using the analogy of a railway train with the engine at the front and the carriages hung out behind to the caboose. Obviously, the engine markets are China, India, and Brazil, and the caboose at the back are those three we've just named. And what is happening is, up until very recently, the engine is well on its way into the next cyclical bear market, and the caboose hadn't quite got to the top. But as I speak to you now, I think the caboose has just gone over the brow of the hill. We're not only in a secular downtrend, we're in the next cyclical bear market as well.
Robin, as I look at these markets, it's been sort of like a risk on and a risk off. The market goes up, then we hit a crisis, whether it's Greece, now it's the debt ceiling in the U.S., and then we go down. They all seem to be linked. What do you think is the cause behind that? Because when stocks are going up, you're seeing commodities go up. All assets seem to be linked together today.
You're absolutely correct. Things that used not to be correlated together are correlated together now, so that we've only got one trade. It's risk on or risk off. And I think the source of this is twofold. Massive amounts of liquidity. And it is not only the U.S. Fed that's been providing that, other central banks have been doing it too, has driven the normally safe assets of bonds or treasury bonds to extremely expensive levels or interest rates to very cheap levels. And this liquidity has had to slosh around the world into other asset classes. And of course, it's the same investment managers controlling that. So when an investment manager needs to raise cash again, they'll all sell the same sort of thing. So that's what's linking us up, really. We live in an excessively joined-up world at the moment.
Now, given the fact that we may be heading into a bear market, what would that imply for, let's say, the dollar and bonds? Because while stocks and commodities have been going up, the dollar has been in a downtrend. Does that mean
absolutely
a reversal in the dollar?
It ought to mean exactly that, yes. For as long as equities were going up and being pumped up, the dollar was in the downtrend. And if we're now getting tops on most other markets, it ought to mean a dollar rally. And in fact, particularly against the astonishing thing is, in spite of all the problems in Greece, Ireland, Portugal, Spain, Italy, the euro has actually been in an uptrend against the dollar. And the level at which that uptrend would break and you go into a dollar rally is 140 on the charts. And we actually went to that level and looked like we would break it into the dollar rally. And it's only the politicking around going on in Washington at the moment that's prevented that. But the recent weakness of the dollar is indistinguishable from mere volatility. My call will be, number one, America will not default. They'll go to the brink of the 11th hour. And then as markets come down, we will get a dollar rally. But the dollar rally is in the context of a secular downtrend in the dollar. It's actually been in a secular trend since Eisenhower and is on its way down. But we're going to get a significant dollar rally. I mean, just to put numbers on it, in the last 1 year, the Swiss franc has gone up more than 25% against the dollar. And if we get a reversal into the dollar, a minimum forecast would be a half retracement of that move. So we're looking at certainly a 12 and possibly a 15% rally in the dollar. But we haven't yet signaled it until the euro crosses that 140 line.
Robin, what would this imply? Okay, let's say that the stock market starts to go down, and I'm following the economic fundamentals, which tend to be weakening every single month, whether you're looking at the leading economic indicators, industrial production, et cetera. What if we get another policy response in the form of who knows what they'll call it? Maybe they won't call it QE3, or we get some kind of tax cut at the end of the year. Yeah. The most important unemployment rate in Washington is for politicians. So would that change your scenario?
Well, yes. Actions of the Fed and other people like that have been able to bend what I would call the shorter-term cycles out of shape. Nobody is big enough to bend the secular trends out of shape. Those are like the tectonic plate movements of the world. But they certainly, last October, which is normally the seasonally weakest period of the year, in comes Bernanke on his white horse and says, I'm going to announce QE. And the market said, yippee, and up it went, as though the normal seasonal dip didn't happen. But there's a learning curve in here. On QE1, there was euphoria. It's great. On QE2, oh, thank God for that. It's okay. I think if he says, certainly by the time you get to QE to the nth, the market says, yeah, this doesn't work, does it? And even the announcement will be taken bearishly. And I think QE3, if that's where we are, it may only be a five-minute wonder if it happens. I mean, the bottom line is the Western world, the entire Western world, though without singling out a particular country, is deep in debt. It's been living now, paying later, leaving its children and grandchildren with debt. And they're spent out, basically, and it can't go on. We've passed the tipping point. Reinhardt and Rogoff point out in This Time It's Different, meaning it's never different. Once you go past this tipping point of the total debt being big in proportion to the world, to the GNP, you just get like a snowball deeper and deeper into debt the further you roll on down the hill. And it ends badly. And I think we've already passed the tipping point. And I think Joe Sixpack, or if that's the name of the public in America, he gets it. He is trying to get his own personal balance sheet sorted out. Firstly, he'd like a job. And secondly, he'd like to pay down his debts and just get out of debt. And as consumption is so important in the U.S. And indeed everywhere else, the consumption is not going to be great. And that plus falling house prices, and you've seen the Case-Shiller index dropping some more, is what locks in the secular downtrend. In fact, I'd go so far as to say we are on the giant cycles at the equivalent part that last time we got there, it was the Great Depression of the 30s. The difference is, thank God, is that this time around, unlike then when if the U.S. and Britain turned down together, the world had a depression. This time around, we've got the emerged markets, China, India, Brazil, and all those connected to it, that are now sufficiently significant and been growing fast enough to mean that the global economy won't actually have a depression. But in pockets in the West are already in depressionary conditions. But we're so big, the economy, it's only pockets, it's not the whole thing. So my take is that the big Western economies will in fact bumble along for several more years, at least 5, possibly 10, with growth rates averaging 1.5 to 2%. One quarter may be more than that, but then the next one will be less. But thank goodness the Asian and emerged part of the economy, even in its slowed down condition, is growing a lot faster than that. And that's what's going to save the world. The trouble is, those markets have got their foot on the brakes right now, trying to get rid of inflation, which is local to them and very violent. And so just at the moment, not only are they leading us down rather than saving the day, but on a longer term perspective, the world economy will probably grow at 4%, thanks to the very rapid growth in the emerged part of the world.
I want to talk about a sector that seems to be bucking the trend. And if you take a look at energy, our demands for high-tech materials, whether we're using cell phones, iPads, etc., and that's rare earth minerals. Because if you look at the charts of, you know, the companies that will probably go into production first, Molycorp, Linus, Great Western Minerals, they all seem to be breaking out.
Yes, they do. I think this is one of the few hot areas in Western world. They won't be totally immune from, crash-type conditions, because when people suddenly need, I just need cash, they'll sell whatever they can sell. But I think that the Western world has an urgent need to find, produce, and refine more rare earths, because because this is a growing area, and we can't be held to ransom with all the current supply coming from China. So I think this is a hot topic, and the right way to play it is to put a little bit of money into several stocks in this area. You've named some of the relatively big ones. There are quite a lot which are small, and quite frankly, they will be high beta. And we don't know which one will go bust on us, but which one will hit the jackpot, as it were. So I think the safe way to play it for most people is to pick six or five or six and put one unit's worth of money into those stocks. And then you can be relatively relaxed about your total exposure to what could be a 10-bagger type of play.
Let's turn our attention, given the fact that we've seen a lot of money printing, whether it's in Europe, the United States, and elsewhere around the world. We've seen gold break out to new levels on the day you and I are speaking. It's well over 1,600. Silver's over 40. What's your take on precious metals?
Particularly gold is my biggest single position personally. I have a larger proportion of my money in gold than we would ever allow a client to. We want our clients to be more diversified than I am. So I'm not a gold bug, but I think the extraordinary economic conditions we're living through now, with many central banks abusing the ability to create liquidity, we need to hedge that risk. And it's very important what Chinese and Indian people think, because they are going to be so big in the future. And in their culture, this is real money. We know over here Lord Keynes said gold was a barbarous relic, but he's a dead Western economist and he's irrelevant now. It what the Asians think that matters most.
Yeah. And then finally, I guess, if you expect the dollar to, let's say, rally as the risk trade comes off and Western markets head into a downturn, what would this imply for some of the other currencies? And I'm thinking of especially the hard currencies that are backed by resources such as the Canadian dollar and the Australian dollar.
Yeah, absolutely. Those would be my bankers. Their long-term trends are unequivocally clearly upwards. However, they do get a little bit overheated from time to time, damaging the local economy. I mean, Canada's got two economies, hasn't it? It's got the Alberta commodity economy, and then it's got the East Coast, which struggles and is anyway linked to the U.S. domestically. And even in Australia, they get a bit overheated. So if these two currencies were ever to fall back to roughly parity with the U.S. dollar, that would be a fantastic entry point, because longer term, they're likely to trend up and stay up from there. I think they're going to be safe. I also think that China is lobbying internationally that it's too soon for the renminbi to take over being the world's currency from the dollar, too soon by 20, 30 years. But what it would quite like to see is a basket currency managed by, say, the World Bank or somebody like that. And if you were to build that basket today, a quarter of it would be the U.S. dollar. Something slightly smaller than that would be the euro, and we'd include the yen and Aussie and Canadian in as well. But the other thing they definitely want to be included in a basket is something nobody can print, no central bank, and they would want gold bullion to be in there from that point of view. And to protect themselves on this ambition, they've made themselves now the largest miners of bullion on the planet, China. They've overtaken other nations in that.
Robin, if I was to sum up, you expect now that the caboose, which has been the large Western markets like the United States and Germany, now to head into their secular bear market trends, in which case you would expect the dollar to rally. How would you play this if you were looking out 3 to 6 months? Where would you put your money?
Well, within the world market universe, I think there's no doubt that Germany and Europe and the U.S. will hold up relatively better than the other markets. So my predictions are the strongest markets, those two particularly, and possibly the U.K. FTSE, which is a very international index, will retrace between a third and a half of what they've made since March 2009. The next weakest category, places like France, will go back down to where they were in March 2009. And the final very weakest category are already lower than they were in March 2009, but they're in the sort of basket case bracket. So basically, for the duration of this bear trade, which is likely to be, on average, if you look back through history, between 9 and 12 months, you're trying to protect wealth for a reasonably significant pullback. Could be 20% in the strongest markets, but it could be 50% in the weakest markets. If I'd like to chuck in one more thing, using value considerations, my concept of the value, I would use the cyclically adjusted P/E ratio. That suggests that Western equities are, in fact, not that cheap, even though earnings are growing. They are, in fact, by their own historic standards of that measure, extremely expensive, leaving scope for quite a big downside move, a frighteningly large downside move, actually.
So finally, Robin, if our listeners would like to follow your work, how could they do so?
Well, I do write a newsletter, which is published by Investment Research of Cambridge, called World Investment Strategy. And they can get access to that. I ought to point out that I don't sign it, although I do write the whole thing. The reason why I don't sign it is because it's a different company from my main employer, and we don't want my thoughts in the newsletter to be seen as the house view of my main employer, because there isn't a house view. Each portfolio here is bespoke to the specific requirements of the client, so there isn't a standard product. So I'm in my own newsletter, I can state unequivocally, clearly, free of all politics, what I say, and that's the way to get it.
All right. We've been speaking with Robin Griffiths from Casino Capital. Robin, I want to thank you for joining us on the Financial Sense News Hour. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
If you have been watching Congress over the last 20 or 30 years, you know that there's sort of a kabuki theater that kicks in every time we get to the budget. And there's plussing or minusing about we're saving this, we're bringing the deficit down, we had a balanced budget. All of these claims and counterclaims that are being made. The bottom line is when everybody votes on something and there's a lot of prestidigitation that goes on here and number flashing that keeps everybody confused, you've noticed that the debt keeps going up and up and up and up and up and up. That's what the Tea Party has reacted to and said, we can't do this forever, as have a lot of people in the private investment community and elsewhere. We can't keep doing this. This has to stop somewhere. And we have an artificially set, of course, debt ceiling crisis. That's what we're facing right now. But a lot of this, as I said, is prestidigitation. When they talk about, we're saving $4 trillion. Well, yeah, that's $4 trillion over 10 years. Take $4 trillion divided by 10, and you see what we're really saving, and you know that just about 12 months from now, they'll change all of that again. But the problem is the prestidigitation isn't working as well as it used to, because reality does come crashing home at soon, sometime or another. And sooner or later, the U.S. is going to have to default on its debt. And the only question is, how? It's a question of when and how. I think that's a pretty good round out on where we're starting this with.
Yeah, and I think, John, you hit upon a point. Ever since we went off gold backing of the dollar, politicians in Washington have been able to go on a spending spree, and especially over the last decade, between a combination between Bush and Obama have been a disaster on the budget. And not only are we involved in three wars, but, I mean, government spending as a percentage of the economy is now 25%. So I think the real issue in the 2012 presidential election is going to be, do we want a country that has a smaller government sector and a more prosperous private sector, or do we want a country that has a less prosperous, higher government sector and a less prosperous private sector? So that's the big issue. But this whole thing that we're seeing every single night is really just political theater, because the U.S. will not default on its debt. I mean, if the Fed can print $600 billion in 5 or 6 months to buy treasuries, if worse came to worse, all the Fed would have to do is the government issue debt, the Fed would buy that debt, and the government would have enough to pay its bills. So a lot of this, as you talked about, is just political theater. But here's the interesting thing is I don't think it's really dawned on these guys yet that at some point they're going to have to curb the spending. You know, doing big entitlements, doing big spending programs, fighting three wars, we simply don't have the money. I mean, every bullet that is fired in a war, every missile that's fired, is paid for with 40 cents out of every dollar that we spend is borrowed. And that percentage is going to be increasing every single year.
I always remember walking into a bank 20 years ago in line with this, and there was a little sign posted there. You know, it was a bank, and your savings, your deposits, all guaranteed by the full faith and credit of the United States government. And I laughed right out loud, and I think the assistant manager turned around and looked at me, and I made some comment about the sign. But the U.S. has a long history of defaulting. This is nothing new for us, so why would we think that it's going to be something new this time around?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the interesting things, and we interviewed the author last year on the program, and that was the professor Kenneth Rogoff from Harvard. He co-authored a book called This Time It's Different with Carmen Reinhart, and both of them, the book was about an 800-year history of financial folly, and what it shows, that government defaults on debt are nothing new. All countries have done it. But, John, you bring up an issue that in this country, we have a history. For example, I'm just going to go through these quickly, but back in 1779, when the country was first formed, the U.S. had issued several million dollars of Spanish milled dollars, we called them continental dollars, to fight the Revolutionary War. But the states couldn't pay them off. So in November of 1779, Congress agreed to redeem the notes with currency that was worth less than 1/38 the original continental value. So that was the first default. Then we did it again, was our second default. In 1790, the Continental Congress had borrowed money both domestically and abroad, and it totaled roughly about 11 million Spanish dollars. And they were receiving, the interest on the debt was paid primarily from money that we were borrowing from France and Holland, of course, then the French Revolution. So Congress defaulted on its domestic debt back in 1782 by refusing to pay interest. And then you would have to go, I think, the next area. The third default was during the Civil War. In August of that year, to fund the Civil War, Congress created a new currency, which became known as the greenback. And the original greenbacks, I think there was like over 60 million in demand notes, and they were backed by gold. But in January 1782, 5 months after the issuing of these notes, the U.S. Treasury defaulted by refusing to redeem them on demand. So that was the third default. Then, this is the one probably most people are familiar with, but the fourth default was the Liberty Bond defaults and gold devaluation of 1934. When we went to war, First World War, Congress issued Liberty Bonds. The last bond was issued, I think, at the end of the war. And when Franklin Roosevelt entered office, the interest payments alone were draining the Treasury from gold. So in addition, the total debt of the country climbed to somewhere around $22 billion. So during the Depression, we reneged on our gold backing, and then on top of that, the president turned around and confiscated gold in this country at $20 an ounce, and then he immediately devalued the currency by 40%. And immediately, in 1 month, deflation effectively ended in the United States. And if you can look at the charts of the CPI, if you can go back to earlier charts, and this is reported at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, you can take a look at the month that Roosevelt devalued gold. We started going from deflation, declining prices, to rising inflation. So that was the fourth devaluation. The fifth devaluation occurred in 1971 when President Nixon abolished the dollars linked to gold. So that was number five. The sixth devaluation is occurring right before our eyes.
Yeah, but Jim, every time we have these devaluations, you know, they seem nice and sanitary, but somebody always gets hurt by these devaluations. Somebody has to pay for the government to rebalance its books, and if it doesn't do it by taxes, it does it by this revaluation. And really what people ultimately wind up doing, no matter how they do it, the value of the dollar falls down. Prices, this is the way the public sees it, prices are going up and up and up. And so people always feel like they're swimming uphill for some reason that they don't understand. You know, if you look at the dollar index, it reached a high of about 121 back in July of 2001. The dollar index is now 74. That means it's lost 40% of its value in just a decade, in the last 10 years, since we've been doing this show.
Yeah. And, I mean, if you take a look at everything that you buy today, go to a grocery store, a lot of the fruits and vegetables are flown in from overseas. Go to a department store, take a look at where the goods are made. They're not made here. You pull into a gas station, well, you know what? 70% of our energy is imported into this country. So when the chairman says, well, you know, the dollar really doesn't affect Americans because we pay for our goods in dollars, yeah, we do, but those goods are purchased from overseas. So as the dollar declines, it means those goods go up, whether it's the price of oil, it's the price of shoes, or it's, you know, electronics, a TV set, whatever it is that you're buying. And so that's one of the big risks that we're going to be talking about today, and we're going to continue our discussion. But, John, the seventh way that we're going to default on our debt, and I just want to emphasize once again that this is political theater in Washington. Technically, there are so many things the government could do to avoid defaulting on its debt. And if worse came to worse, once again, the Fed could step in. I mean, if the Fed can spend $16 trillion bailing out foreign central banks, financial institutions, foreign governments, it would not be a problem for the Fed to step in with another $1 trillion and bail out the U.S. government by simply printing money out of thin air. And, of course, that would be looked upon negatively for the dollar. But so a lot of this is political theater. But the way I think that we're going to work our way out of this, and it's been a theme that we've been highlighting here on the program, is financial repression. And that means we are going to keep interest rates artificially low for as long as we can, and it'll be probably for the next decade. So if you're a saver, you're going to be getting almost zero interest on your savings. The second thing that we're going to do is we're going to increase the level of inflation. And this has all kinds of ramifications in terms of what we're going to hear reported in the economy, on unemployment, and also on inflation. At the same time they're going to do that, they're going to rejigger the way we report inflation, so we're going to understate it even further than it's already understated. And as we did a program here back, John, remember when we talked about financial entitlements?
But you know, Jim, we hear about the Paul Ryan program, the president's plan, and the bottom line, when all is said and done, they're going to have to cut entitlements to whatever these programs are. They're going to have to lower deductions on the income tax at the very same time they're going to bring in a sales tax. Now, the way they're going to sell this to the public is they'll drop the tax down and really do something to begin with. As we put in the national sales tax, they'll drop the income tax, and then 24 months later, raise it right up and smash out the deductions. That's how the game's going to be played, I would predict.
Well, that's exactly what they did. Everybody remembers the tax reforms that came in under President Reagan, where he took the tax rates from 50% down to 28%. He got rid of the tax shelters. He got rid of the deduction for, let's say, sales tax. He limited pension deductions. And all of the elimination of the deductions occurred in the first year of the plan. However, the lower income tax rates were phased in over a three-year period. And then, of course, when Reagan left office, the first thing that Bush did, Bush Sr., was he raised the tax rates from 28% to 31%, and then he raised the Medicare tax all the way up to $125,000 on a person's income. And then, of course, Clinton came in 1993, raised the tax rates to 39.6, and then he lifted the ceiling on the Medicare tax, so you now pay 2.9 if you're unemployed on all of your earned income, or 1.45 if you are an employee of another corporation.
So what we're watching, you call it a kabuki drama in Washington, is really what's been going on for the last 20 or 30 years. It's really a bunch of spoiled children, that's the best way you'd put it, who really don't want to, you know, she'll have fun till her daddy takes the T-Bird away. Remember that old song came out of the 60s? And it's the same deal. They don't want the credit card taken away. Every year we play this little theater about throwing this in the budget, taking that out, but they still keep charging and charging and charging. And that's where we're at right now. They have not internalized the value that at some point or another the party really does come to an end.
Yeah, and anytime they do a budget cut, you know, they say we're going to cut $4 trillion. If you look closely at the details, The budget cuts occur 6-8 years from now. And then, of course, everybody, once the bill's passed and all the theater is removed, who's going to remember a year from now? It's just like, remember the budget cuts back in 1991? Well, they never took place because in the later years, they just went around it and got rid of those budget cuts and continued. And they can do that with emergency spending. They can say, oh, we need to spend another $100 billion on this program. It's an emergency, so you get around the budget cuts.
So I would guess we would say that having observed all of that, we're going to see this kabuki drama continue. But it does come to one of those dramatic, I don't know if it'll be a Goethe Dämmerung type of thing, you know, or whether the hero just slips off into the sunset, one or the other. But one way or another, we'll track it right here on Financial Sense. More to come on the Financial Sense News Hour. Are we moving into some kind of stagflation? Well, there's a word we haven't heard for a long time. And will that lead to some kind of hyperinflation? Maybe a gradual hyperinflation, but a hyperinflation nevertheless. We'll also discuss how investors are to find income in an environment where for some time to come, interest rates may be very, very low. The baby boomers are going to find themselves squeezed on all quadrants. As prices rise, interest rates go low, and government benefits decrease. All of that and your calls on the Q lines coming up in the next hour of Financial Sense at FinancialSense.com. We'll be right back.